From Louisiana to Wisconsin, Illinois to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, since efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare failed last year, health care reform has been put on the back burner. But problems persist and more taxpayer dollars may be spent. Nina Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation is here with an update. Democrats appear to have won a special congressional election in Pennsylvania, and Mississippi will have two U.S. Senate races this year. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Larry Kudlow is President Trump's pick to head the National Economic Council. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about the impact with Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center. And presidential scholar Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College examines the stylistic differences between Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In their biggest legislative defeat of 2017, Republicans in the U.S. Senate fell one vote short of making major changes to the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare. That doesn't mean the problems with the system went away. In fact, more taxpayer subsidies are being discussed. Nina Schaefer is Senior Research Fellow in Health Policy at the Heritage Foundation. She joins us now with an update. Nina, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Nina, it has been a while since we've really focused on Obamacare, on health care reform. So I understand that there is some movement in Congress to add some significant taxpayer dollars to health care. Please bring us up to date on what's happening.
Sure. Well, as you know, Congress right now is trying to finish up its fiscal 18 funding bill, and that's kind of where all the cats and dogs get thrown in here in Washington to kind of finish out the year. And what we've been hearing through reports through the media and elsewhere is that Congress is considering funneling billions of dollars to prop up the Obamacare bill. And in particular, trying to prop up what we already know has been a failed infrastructure for the health care law. As you know, we've predicted when this health care law first came into place that the massive regulatory overreach and infrastructure that was put in place was going to raise premiums, lower choices, and really create instability in the market as a whole. And that's exactly what's happened. But really, rather than addressing those issues, these bailouts that Congress is considering really just papers over those underlying problems that the health care law originally created. And we think it's really a distraction from what they really should be doing, which is to revive efforts on a repeal and replace mechanism, kind of to jumpstart that focus so that we can shift attention away from trying to save Obamacare and really focus on getting us on the right path.
In terms of repeal and replace, we actually haven't heard that phrase in quite a number of months now. Is that still on the radar screen?
Well, I certainly think there have been comments that kind of stalled in the Senate, and there were earlier this year comments by Senator Cruz as well as Senator Graham saying we really think that we still need to do this and address this issue. I think as a policy matter, it has to be addressed. Otherwise, what this Congress is putting itself on a path for is just an ongoing bailout structure for a law that they were opposed to. If you look at what Democrats have already done, they are moving away from Obamacare. You don't see any of them calling for bailouts. They're talking about doing something completely different towards a single-payer system. They're retreating from what the mess that they've created. And now this Congress and this administration now have on their plates, what are we going to do with this mess? And I don't think that the bailout approach is really making any difference in the long-term trajectory of where we need to go on the healthcare debate. And so any kind of efforts that we can really focus on and Congress can focus on that moves us away from just papering over the mistakes of Obamacare and really getting at the fundamental underlying issues and getting better healthcare policy in place rather than just helping to keep Obamacare afloat.
In terms of this bailout, even if it is approved, Nina, for the upcoming fiscal year, is this something that Congress is going to have to do year after year after year unless they actually do implement some reforms?
Certainly, we have to wait to see what the final language is. We haven't seen. These are just kind of reports of what they're negotiating. But theoretically, it would have, since it's an appropriations bill, it would have to be on an annual basis. So year after year, this Congress and future Congresses would have to continue to fund and prop up Obamacare. And I think that that is just the opposite of what this Congress should be doing. And really, not only a distraction, but it takes the wind out of any efforts to do real reform. If all you're doing is going on autopilot to just add more money, which, by the way, we spent almost $1 trillion to get Obamacare. Why we're adding even more money to it is beyond me. But continuing to fund the Obamacare infrastructure really takes away the incentive as well as the momentum to do anything different to get to real health care reform.
What happens, Nina, if Congress does not provide additional subsidies?
Well, certainly we would have to see what happens. That's actually a great point to raise. We don't even know what the health insurance premiums will be for next year. Insurance plans have not had to put out any kind of notifications of what their bids are going to be, et cetera. This could be throwing money at a problem that really isn't even a problem. So that's the other thing, that Congress is, I think, acting a little premature in focusing on this. If they do not move this way, it does create an opportunity for them, as I said, to kind of revive some efforts on repeal and replace, understanding that this underlying market cannot be saved, and what we need to do is get the real reforms, rolling back the regulatory infrastructure, redesigning the entire way that they're trying to subsidize health insurance, and really getting us back to a more market-based approach to health care.
As part of the Tax Cuts and Job Creation Act that was passed at the end of the year last year, Nina, one of the components of that was to eliminate the individual mandate, which means that now folks don't have to pay a penalty on their income tax if, in fact, they do not have health care coverage. Is that going to result in a significant loss of revenue to help cover these expenses?
That's a great point, that the individual mandate, the penalty itself was dropped to zero in future years. That doesn't mean that the penalty is totally gone. We have articulated that we think we should remove it entirely. But, you know, that's a great example of, even some might argue that the individual mandate, wow, look at all the problems that are caused if you give people the option of not participating in a government-run plan. The same can be true with these bailouts, which is, why would we now support a bailout infrastructure just because, oh my gosh, it might save some money here and there because we'll have more people participating in the markets? That's kind of the opposite of what we're looking for. So the individual mandate and the removing of the penalty there really, I think, is the direction that Congress should continue to focus on, which is starting to peel away, layer by layer, a repeal and replace strategy, rather than just turning its head away and saying, well, we'll just pour more money after bad money.
So we have removed the first layer of that onion. What is the next step, in your view, that Congress should take if we're going to start to move away from this Obamacare disaster and into a more free market-based system?
Well, certainly I think efforts of trying to reengage with the states, in particular states already, because they have closer to the issue, are looking to figure out ways to get around it. If you look at Alaska, for example, they've used some waiver authority to try to reprogram some of the funding, not new funding, existing federal funding, as well as Wisconsin, I believe, has now looked at figuring out how can they help to stabilize their marketplace. I think Congress should really revisit efforts that looked at kind of working with the states to have kind of a tag team partnership on how to get health care reform and a repeal and replace initiative underway. It is going to be a long process. This is not one bill that's going to solve all this.
We will continue to keep an eye on all of this, as we have been talking with Nina Schaefer, who is a senior research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Heritage, of course, based in Washington, D.C. Nina, tell us a bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, where can folks go on the web to read more about this?
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is a public policy think tank here in Washington, D.C. that is conservative, where we promote the principles of free enterprise, limited government, individual freedom, traditional values, and a strong military defense, which is kind of shows you the large scope. And you can read more about our work at heritage.org.
Nina Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation. Nina, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth, and this week, instead of talking about what's happening in Congress, we're going to talk about what's happening to Congress in terms of special elections that are occurring around the country. Andy, good to have you here.
Always a pleasure, Loman.
So we had a special election in Pennsylvania 18, And that district lies to the east and south of the city of Pittsburgh, a district Donald Trump won by 20 points in 2016. What happened in the special election?
Well, the Democrat appears to have won. You know, they're still kind of finalizing things. There's no mandatory recount, but Connor Lamb, the Democrat, won by just a few hundred votes. The Democrats, of course, are claiming victory, and it seems like unless something unexpected occurs, I think that they will have won the seat. This is going to energize the Democrat base. The Democrat pocketbooks are going to open, so candidates all across the country are going to probably get an infusion of more money from all corners of the party. And then they're just going to stay motivated until November. And the idea is that they're going to take back the House of Representatives. That's going to be incredibly unfortunate. And Republicans should stop being so, they're on their heels when it comes to legislating, and they're not putting out an aggressive pro-growth agenda. But their majority to lose unless they change their ways. But in Pennsylvania, the Democrats fielded a candidate who was very mainstream, young, good-looking guy, military veteran. I have no doubt that he's going to be very liberal in his voting record, but he portrayed himself as a moderate. Rick Scone, the Republican, very conservative, but just not as charismatic and energetic as a candidate compared to the Democrat. So the Democrats now have the ball. Republicans just have to figure out what to do next.
We will point out that the candidates in this special election were selected by party conferences as opposed to primaries. So Connor Lamb was able to win the nomination to run for this without having to tilt really far to the left to win a primary like Democrats normally do. That allowed him to be more moderate in what is a very conservative district. But this district, Andy, because the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania threw out the congressional district map a couple of weeks ago and by fiat implemented its own congressional district map, this district disappears. So,
yeah, that's the irony out of all of this is regardless of who wins, and it probably is going to be the Democrat Connor Lamb, neither man will have the ability to run again in this district because the district lines have changed. But that's assuming that the Supreme Court's district lines hold, and I believe it appears that they will, but there still remains some judicial doubt that that's the case. But assuming that those lines do hold, Rick Saccone will likely move approximately 1 mile from his house to run in the 14th district, which is very conservative. It's more conservative than the 18th that he just lost. And as of now, he has no competition, Republican or Democrat, although it's maybe a little too early to tell. Connor Lamb, the Democrat, is going to be running against Keith Rothfuss, an incumbent Republican congressman from that area. I think it's in the 17th district. And Keith Rothfuss, he used to represent a very conservative district, and now that district has been whittled down to basically a swing district. So he's going to have a really tough fight on his hands, and Connor Lamb will again have to start campaigning to win that seat. But the irony out of all of this is that the special election, it means something, but the district itself is going away in November.
Let's now turn our attention to the South and the great state of Mississippi, where it appears that there's going to be a special election for a U.S. Senate seat, as well as there's the state's second U.S. Senate seats on the ballot this year. So sort out for us what's happening in Mississippi.
Yeah, it's bonkers what's going on. Your listeners may recall back in 2014, State Senator Chris McDaniel ran against incumbent Senator Thad Cochran. McDaniel is a young, energetic candidate, very conservative, and he was challenging Thad Cochran, who had been in the Senate since the 70s, big spending liberal Republican. Chris McDaniel won that primary against Cochran, but lost in the runoff because neither men got 50%. And I think for a lot of conservatives, they believe that that race was stolen by a lot of party switching votes and some other shenanigans. So a lot of conservatives are upset by that. Chris McDaniel is now back. he announced recently that he was going to run against Mississippi's other senator, Roger Wicker. And that race was in its infancy until just recently when Thad Cochran announced his resignation. And so that opens up the other seat, the seat that McDaniel originally sought back in 2014. The governor, the Republican governor, is going to make an appointment there, but that will cause a special election in November. And the special election in November will be what we call a jungle primary, where Republicans and Democrats all run together in one big election, and then the top two finishers would presumably run in a runoff in December. The reason I point all this out is that Chris McDaniel just announced that he is no longer running against Roger Wicker and that he is going to run against whoever the governor appoints. The governor may appoint somebody very conservative, which would make it very awkward and unlikely that McDaniel could win, or the governor could appoint someone in the establishment, and that will generate a big conservative versus establishment fight, just like we saw in 2014. So the drama is very much alive and well down in Mississippi, and it's going to be interesting how it unfolds.
Let's also hop westward and briefly set the stage for the next special congressional election, which will be in Arizona 8.
The Democrats, being emboldened by their victory in Pennsylvania 18, they're now looking at Arizona 8. They can certainly look at it and get energized, but I doubt that they're going to win. Pennsylvania 18 did go with Trump more in Pennsylvania 18 than in Arizona 8 by one percentage point. But Arizona 8, the demographics are much more different. Unlike in Pennsylvania, it's much more Republican, lifelong Republicans, a lot of retirees, and the candidates are much more different. The Republican candidate, Debbie Lesko, is very well known. She's very well liked, and the Democrat is underfunded and not very well known. Now, the Democrats are certainly going to try, but I think at the end of the day, Republicans will hold that seat easily.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth, as always, from the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll chat with you next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Larry Kudlow, the CNBC financial commentator and frequent advisor to the Trump administration, will now head the National Economics Council. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Veronique Drugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University discuss the appointment. Eric?
Most of the talk out of the White House this week centered on who was leaving, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, that is, but also important is who's coming on board. And that's something we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique Drugi. She is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist at Reason.com. And her latest column takes a look at one of those new hires in the White House, specifically Larry Kudlow, who is the new director of the National Economic Council. He is going to be one of President Donald Trump's top advisors. And as Drugi writes in that column, Kudlow has been a longtime advocate for low taxes and free trade. And hey, Veronique, that sounds a lot like somebody else. That sounds like you, a longtime advocate for low taxes and free trade. Thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'd like to say, though, Kudlow's been at it way longer than I.
Maybe that's true. He's been doing it a bit longer, but we are certainly glad to have you, Veronique. Now, look, most people who know Larry Kudlow, or most people who heard of Larry Kudlow, probably know him from his appearances on CNBC, where he's been a longtime commentator on there. But he's also a highly regarded economist. And as you say, he's been an advocate for low taxes and free trade for a long time here. Let's just jump right to the big question. Is this a good hire for the Trump administration? Is he somebody who's going to help steer the White House in the right direction?
I think actually it is the right pick for right now. I think that Larry Kudlow has the right kind of skills. He's a great person. He is always willing to listen and to push back when he disagrees, but he has a personality and a media experience that I think will serve him extremely well in that job. And maybe he more than anyone else could actually control the worst instinct of this president.
Yeah, personality-wise, I think it seems like he could be a good fit in there, Veronique. And I mean, look, we talk about this White House as being like a reality show so often, and that's because the president seems to relish that sort of environment of chaos and of having the cameras constantly on. And I don't want to diminish Larry Kudlow's intellect at all, because that's obviously a very important part of the role that he will play here. But I mean, at the same time, he's got experience with the media and with the idea of sort of always being able to stay on message or at least understanding what that message is, which is something that this White House has struggled with. So it seems like in that regard, he probably fits in both in terms of what the White House needs and also in terms of what President Trump wants. He likes having those kinds of TV personalities, people who are comfortable in the spotlight around him. And so it seems like that might fit together pretty well.
Yeah, and I also think that because Larry understands the media environment we're in, he can also kind of maybe, I mean, it's just an assumption, maybe like kind of make the president understand that not everything you think is worth saying out loud on Twitter to millions of people. And we'll see. I mean, no one seems to have been able to do this, but maybe because you're right, there is a shared experience, there is a shared kind of public figure aspect of the two men, maybe he'll be able to reach out to him in a way that Gary Cohn, who shares on trade and taxes a lot of the inclination of Larry Kudlow, couldn't.
I guess the flip side to all of that could be that, you know, look, the Trump administration at the moment seems so fixated in terms of economic policy on protectionism, on tariffs, things like this. Now, you said earlier that Kudlow gets along well with people who he disagrees with. He likes making the case for free markets and for low regulation, things like that. But there's going to be people in this White House that he disagrees with on some of those policies. What does that mean for him and for the chance that he can steer things in the right direction?
As far as I know, and as long as he's been vocal on this issue, he's been a free trader. And he was good on immigration policy. I mean, during the Reagan years, he used to call, that's according to him, he would say, you know, we would call the free traders the white hats and the protectionists the black hats. And he lamented that the black hats had won this time around in this administration. So he's going to be certainly having to navigate this environment. But I will say that the reason why I think also this may work, not for the best for us, but that may work also, and he may be a more smooth operator than others, is because also, I mean, there are areas where he is kind of like stepped back from his free trade policy. Where, for instance, he says he's in favor of not blanket tariffs like the president announced, but targeted tariffs, and that he justifies it by saying, well, you know, China is a horrible offender, they steal our intellectual property. Yeah, all true, but, and so we need to like punish them with tariffs, to which I say I just don't understand why on one hand you're capable of making this passionate argument against tariffs as an import tax and as really a punishment to American consumer and still think it's a good idea in a more targeted context. I think we're just going to be talking about trade for quite a while, and so that's going to stay on the agenda. I'm worried that spending is not going to get any attention from anyone, and yet it just, it needs to, and it's actually shocking that as the economy is growing, as taxes are being cut, they're deficits are growing.
Yeah, no doubt that trade is on the forefront of the agenda there, and maybe someday we'll talk about the spending and the debts and the deficits and how important and how disastrous they could be. I guess we'll have to leave that for another day because we are out of time for today. That is Veronique DeRuggi from the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And you can check out her latest column and all of her columns at Reason.com. She's a weekly columnist for us. The latest one on Larry Kudlow and his history of defending low taxes and free trade and how he could fit into the Trump administration. Again, check that out at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Trump has brought a style of his own to the presidency. So, too, did Ronald Reagan, but in a much different way. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary.
Once again, the presidential historians and scholars are at work crafting rankings of our nation's best and worst presidents. And among them, Ronald Reagan continues to rank very high. Speaking of Reagan, as a Reagan biographer, I always get asked questions about Ronald Reagan at this time of year, especially concerning his personality and character, and particularly in comparison to the current president. Well, there's so much I could say about that, but I'll share this. Ronald Reagan was plainly likable, and central to that likability was his humility. The word "I" didn't dominate his lexicon, unless he was poking fun at himself. In keeping with a biblical exhortation read to him as a boy by his devout mother, Nell Reagan, Reagan humbled himself. He did not exalt himself. On that, I'd like to share an anecdote about Ronald Reagan told me by Bill Clark, who had been Reagan's closest advisor. As a senior official, Clark had a driver, a man named Joe Bullock, a Georgia native who moved to Washington during the Great Depression. Joe, a black man, had suffered the cruel Jim Crow laws that plagued the South. He went to Washington for a better life. Joe first found employment as a mule driver. He eventually traded in the animal for, well, senior government officials, who were much more difficult to navigate. One morning, Bill Clark's father visited Washington. He hit it off with Joe right away. A rancher, he gave Joe a gift, a Western-style belt with a kind of John Wayne belt buckle, as Clark described it. Joe Bullock loved it, proudly displaying it by leaving his suit jacket unbuttoned all the time. That belt soon assumed a life of its own. There was an upcoming state visit by England's Prince Philip. It was customary that the White House provide a gift. Clark and Reagan and a few others brainstormed. Clark suggested a belt. "Well, what does it look like?" asked Reagan. Clark noted that he had a model in the car. "Send him up," ordered President Reagan. Joe entered via the door of Reagan's personal secretary. He had worked for the federal government for 50 years, Joe did, but never got within 50 yards of a president. He saw Clark, Vice President Bush, the senior aides, and then the President of the United States. Overcome, big old Joe, 6'4", began weeping. He had come so far since Jim Crow and the Great Depression. No one in the room was prepared for that. They were dead silent, clueless as to how to respond, except for Ronald Reagan. The president rose, walked over to the driver, extended his hand, breathed in, and said matter-of-factly, "Mr. Bullock, I understand you have a belt to show me." It was an everyman touch by Reagan, a basic respect that put Joe instantly at ease. Businesslike, Joe showed the belt, and then he and Reagan swapped stories, chatting away. The rest of us, Bill Clark told me, just faded away as the two got along famously. Joe Bullock left with a story to tell his fellow drivers and his grandchildren. He died a few years later, and I mention this story now because Joe's daughter contacted me just last week to share this story with Joe's grandchildren. This anecdote is nothing dramatic. It's simply another nice story that I've heard about Ronald Reagan, a good man and a good president. This country has been blessed with many of them, and that's a thought worth bearing in mind as we consider the people who ask us for their presidential vote. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kenyor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WWON-FM in Waynesboro, Kentucky. Welcome to our new listeners in the Bluegrass State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.